Welcome to the Paul Post podcast, in which Professor Post discusses a variety of national security topics. Professor Post is an assistant director of the Chicago Projects on Security and Threats, or CPOST, and the author of three books, The Economics of War, Organizing Democracy, and Arguing About Alliances. You can follow him on Twitter at Prof. Paul Post. So let's begin with Nancy Pelosi rolling into town. Honestly, hasn't Ukraine suffered enough? What is it with all these visits from politicians?
Oh, yes. We've had Nancy Pelosi. We had just recently Jill Biden, the First Lady, arrive. Justin Trudeau, of course, Prime Minister of Canada. A few weeks ago, we had Boris Johnson. The list goes on and on. We've had a variety of dignitaries from the U.S., from NATO countries, arriving in Kyiv to meet with Zelensky. And on the one hand, you could understand why this would be valuable, right? This is a show of support to Ukraine. Sometimes this is done in conjunction with some big announcement of like additional aid and assistance to Ukraine. But on the other hand, it also runs a risk because there is still, even though Kyiv is not currently under siege, there are still strikes happening in that area. And so as a result, you are running a risk of having, whether it's a primary dignitary or even your leader, showing up and potentially being put in harm's way. And then that could lead to questions about if that were to happen, would that be a NATO Article 5 type of situation? Because it would be an attack on a country's leader. I mean, obviously you could say no, yes, but anyways, that's one complication for this. The other one too is it can also carry a bit of a sense of being, you know, maybe for lack of a better word, exploitive, right? You know, the people have talked about it, it's just a photo op. They're showing up to take these photographs, to look, I'm, you know, supporting, you know, it's kind of the war equivalent of the politician in a hard hat at a construction site, right? You know, this is good for, you know, signaling that, look, I'm doing something for you, for the world, for peace. And so those are two criticisms of it. But I think what's important to remember is that they're not showing up forcefully, right? I think they are showing up with the blessing and perhaps even the invitation of Zelensky. And so in many ways, I think that the more valid argument for this is the one that it is a show of support. And in a way, you could even say it goes beyond just a show of support. It's also a little bit of a middle finger, if you will, to Putin to say, look, you started this war and you were trying to take Kyiv and you can't do it. You can't do it to such an extent that we are comfortable having our leaders or other foreign dignitaries show up, meet with Zelensky, someone that you were trying to kill, and actually meet with them in Ukraine in the midst of a war. And so I think that that signaling purpose for it could actually be useful in a way for the morale of the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian government. So again, I can understand why there's criticism of it for sure, but there is some value in the signaling and the morale building elements of these kind of visits.
There may be some value, but there's also the mixed message of these rich folks can fly in and out, no problem, but people trying to flee the country can't leave. Not exactly a good message.
Absolutely. I think that's yet a third criticism that one could make is the idea that, yes, there are people trying to leave. There are people fleeing. They're not in their homes. And maybe they are able to leave, but they're now refugees in Poland, for example. So, yes, it could be viewed that way, that, well, what gives the privilege to this individual to just show up and come in, fly in first class and leave, or, you know, on Air Force One or what have you. So yes, I think that there is some of that. But my sense is that Zelensky is someone who is very savvy about that. You know, I think it's very important to remember that Zelensky is, I mean, he's an actor, right? That was part of his profession, was an actor. A lot of people like to say, you know, he's a comedian, but he was an actor. He was more than just a stand-up comedian, even though that's not to denigrate stand-up comedians. I am a big fan of stand-up comedians, but he's very aware of appearances. he's very aware of symbolism. And this is also part of the reason why he has had all of these great phrases, everything like from the beginning where I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. I mean, that's just like a masterful phrase that really resonated with a lot of people in Ukraine and around the world. So I think that I think he's sensitive to that perception, but I think in his view, he sees the benefit is outweighing that potential cost and criticism. He sees the benefit of this show of support to Ukraine. He sees the benefit of, if you will, this sticking it to Putin by having them show up. And I think that he senses that that is going to do more for building morale than it will for building criticism.
Moving on to other messaging, there's some uneasiness among Europeans about the wisdom of anonymous U.S. officials telling the New York Times that U.S. intelligence has allowed the Ukraine to kill so many Russian generals. What is this all about? What purpose does this boasting serve?
So my understanding is that the White House is now trying to put a stop to that precisely because there has been, I mean, just so much criticism from prominent individuals of like, wait, this seems like not something you should be doing, right? Because if number one, if one of the concerns is starting escalation, right? If one of the concerns is this war escalating into a war directly between NATO and Russia, or even more so the United States and Russia. Well, this is one way to not accomplish that, right? And it seems to go against all the other efforts that NATO and in particular the Biden administration has been taking to try to avoid that very situation. So it seems to go against that completely. It also feeds directly into the narrative that Putin has been putting forward that the West, NATO, the United States, that they're the aggressors. And if you are providing this type of information is being provided, showing that the U.S. is helping to target these individuals and carry out these operations against Ukrainian assets, even though, let's be honest, it's probably like recognized that was going on anyways. I would think that a Russian general would be shocked to find out that Ukraine is receiving intelligence assistance from NATO countries, the United States, the West. I think he would not be shocked to find that out, right? So I think that this is well known, but the fact that they're admitting it, I think, feeds into these concerns about the potential for escalation and the fact that it feeds into the narrative that Putin's putting forward. The other thing it does is it carries the risk of revealing what people like to refer to as sources and methods, right? This is something that is very important with respect to intelligence. This is something that my colleague, Austin Carson, studies with his work on covert operations, and also in particular with the book that he recently co-authored with Allison Carnegie on the use of international organizations to try to help distribute sensitive information. That's a big part of the story, is that states have sources and methods that they don't want to reveal, and they're afraid that if they reveal this intelligence or this information, it will indicate potentially, if not individuals, at least timing of where individuals could have been around. And then, of course, you worry about the other side connecting the dots and saying, oh, wait, that's where that came from. So that's why states are often very sensitive about it. And when you're providing information saying, oh, yeah, we provided the targeting to hit that ship, or we provided the targeting to kill that general, that runs the risk of assisting the Russians in connecting the dots and potentially figuring out where that kind of information is being derived.
Oh, talking about bragging, a lot of people are expecting May 9th, Victory Day, for President Putin to come out and say, mission accomplished. What did we get?
That's right. And this relates to a Twitter thread I put out there late last week. So we're recording this on May 9th. I should say that for those listening, we're recording this on May 9th. And by now, Putin has indeed made his speech. But there were a host of individuals, host of analysts who were wondering if Putin would use this speech to do something big. One of those things was announcing like mobilization, because technically Russia has not yet declared this a war. It's still a special operation. But the other possibility was, since it's Victory Day, and by Victory Day, we mean that this is the day that in this Soviet Union and the former Soviet republics, including Ukraine, they commemorate as the ending of World War II in Europe, that this was the day that Stalin had announced that Nazi Germany had surrendered. And people were wondering if he might use this day to announce some sort of victory, if you will. And so I likened this to when George W. Bush announced mission accomplished, right? At the end of, or not at the end, that's actually the point. It wasn't the end, but at the end of the, quote, major military operations of the Iraq War back in 2003. Now, he didn't actually say mission accomplished. Of course, when he gave his speech back in 2003, he gave this speech, there was a huge banner behind him that said mission accomplished, right? But he did say that we have prevailed in Iraq. And the reality is that, yes, the U.S. had by now, by that moment, had moved into Baghdad, had taken over. You already had the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein. So these things had been accomplished. But even prior to the war, when you look at the motivations for the war, the motivations of the war were, you know, there were manyfold motivations. Was to eliminate the weapons of mass destruction regime or system, that program that Iraq had, and that hadn't yet been done. They didn't even know if he where it was, right? They hadn't found it yet. Or to establish a democracy. Well, that was far from over. And you had a variety of individuals saying that, well, toppling Saddam Hussein's regime will probably be the easy part. The hard part is going to be stabilizing the country afterwards. And they were just starting to enter that. So it wasn't like it was unforeseen that there was still a lot more to do. And even Putin, or excuse me, that was a Freudian slip, even Bush in his speech acknowledged that there was still a lot of work to be done. But nevertheless, he was conveying this idea that, yeah, you know, there's more work to be done, but we're pretty much at the mopping up stage, right? This is, we're just kind of cleaning things up and everybody's going to go along and this is, we're going to wrap things up and come home. And that was very much the tone of that speech. And so the reason why I compared the potential of what Putin could say to that speech was just to make the point that, first of all, if Putin did this, it would not be unprecedented at all. But secondly, both Bush and then potentially what Putin could have said is reflective of a broader idea, which is that leaders look for opportunities to declare wins, even if it's in the course of the war. And so maybe Putin could have even said something about Mariupol to say, oh, well, we've now liberated this city, right? Or we now have, you know, control of the eastern provinces. You know, he could have said any number of things because leaders are always looking for these opportunities for wins and to declare wins. And then that led into an even broader point that I brought up about how when we study the outcomes of war, the truth of the matter is outcomes of war are very often vague. And that creates a lot of space for a leader to declare any number of things to be a win rather than a loss. You know, that's why we're still debating to this day about was the Vietnam War actually a loss for the United States, right? There is a lot of ways that one could look at that to say, well, yes, in one sense it was a loss, but in the other sense it accomplished its objectives, right? So, and if that's a conversation we can have for another time. But the point is that a lot of times wars have these vague enough outcomes that it creates space for leaders to be able to do this. So bringing it back to May 9th, the idea was that, well, maybe Putin will declare some sort of wins, some sort of victory, maybe in the same way as Bush, where he's not yet saying the war is totally over, but he's saying, hey, we've accomplished this and we are progressing and soon this will be over. He didn't do that. Instead, he did something else, which I thought was quite interesting. He ended up using the speech to rehash all of his motivations for the war. But he used a phrase that I thought was very strange, but he said that Russia preemptively struck back, end quote. And when you think about that, that phrase makes absolutely no sense, to preemptively strike back. If you're striking back, then that means you've been hit. But if you're preemptive, then that means you're hitting first. So which of these is actually in play? And the reality is it doesn't really matter, right? This is just part of what these are ideas he's trying to put out there to motivate why he's doing what he's doing. But to me, where it does matter is it's a semantic error that points to kind of the hollowness of the motivations that Russia has for this conflict that Putin has put forward. And so hence he ends up using nonsensical phrases like preemptively striking back.
Okay, I'll forgive the Freudian slip. It's very, very easy to confuse your warmongers. However, criticizing someone for semantic errors hardly seems appropriate when you look at some of the speeches that President Bush gave, Ronald Reagan, I mean, semantic errors are not that uncommon when you're giving a big speech in front of millions of people.
Absolutely. What are some of the great phrases that Bush used? Misunderestimated or something like, I don't know.
There is a whole book on Bushisms.
Bushisms, that's right. But what's interesting is I don't think this is a Bushism. I'm willing to forgive some of these Bushisms because, you know, I mean, like right now, right? We're doing this podcast, you're talking off the top of your head, and sometimes you say things that you're like, oh, I wouldn't quite have said it that way, but I'm just talking off the cuff or trying to think through something. But what's interesting is that Putin's speech there did not seem to be off the cuff. It seemed to be a phrase that he intentionally put in there and wanted to use, right? And so in that sense, it's also like, what is it that he's trying to get at with this? But what he is ultimately trying to get at is he's trying to, and the main reason you use a phrase or you use the word preemption is a classic motivation for war, which is, or I shouldn't say motivation for war, I should say a classic justification for war, which is that it's defensive. We didn't start this. We are taking this action in order to stop aggression, right? And you use the phrase like preemption, or to can go back to Bush, prevention, preventive war. You use that phrase to say, yes, we might be the ones who are striking first, but we're doing so because they're going to strike us. And we're trying to take action before something bad happens. And so I think that that's the idea that Putin was trying to get at. And this is a well-trodden route that many leaders have used when it comes to starting wars. As the historian A.J.P. Taylor said in his book, Struggle for Mastery of Europe, every war between major powers started as a, quote, preventive war, right? That no one has ever admitted that we are the aggressor. No one's going to say that. They're always going to say, no, we are doing this for defensive purposes.
The danger when you have something like this happens is that we forget the rest of the world has news too. What's happening elsewhere beyond the Ukraine?
Oh, boy. There is so much happening elsewhere beyond the Ukraine. And I'm glad that you brought this up. We could have an entire episode just about everything else that's happening in the world. Admittedly, some of these things are related to Ukraine. Some of these things are just not related to Ukraine, but the Ukraine crisis actually brings to light how much we've forgotten about them. So let's start with a couple examples. The war in Yemen. That is still ongoing. The war in Syria, that is still ongoing. There is a war in Ethiopia that is ongoing. That had started way before this conflict, and that is ongoing. We have the potential for new war between Armenia and Azerbaijan. That's another conflict that we see brewing. We still have the conflict in the Himalayas between India and China. That's still going on. We have also, in addition to all of these conflicts, and there's more that we could even list, we also have food crises happening throughout the world. Now, some of this is related to Ukraine. Some of this is related to just the broader supply chain issues that have arisen over the past few years. And that actually takes us to maybe one of the big things that is still ongoing that people seem to have conveniently forgot, which is that there is this pandemic, that this pandemic is still unfolding. Now, it appears that the pandemic is reaching a good point, in that it seems like a lot of the latest data shows that the newest variants of the COVID virus are potentially even less deadly than the flu, especially when in combination with the vaccines. But it's still ongoing. It's still causing disruptions, most notably in Shanghai, where there's been complete lockdown and has led to ports becoming closed. And so as a result, you have the inability to get supplies out into the global supply chain. Food crises breaking out because of the fact that Ukraine is very much the breadbasket of Europe, as it's always been referred to, Russia as well. So you have wheat crises. And even sticking with Europe, you have a crisis in the Balkans. That this is something that a few years ago, at the very first forum by the Pearson Institute, which is at the University of Chicago. They put on this global forum, and they have various policymakers will come in and give speeches. And I remember they had the former foreign minister of Serbia come in and speak. And he talked about how there's potentially going to be another crisis in the Balkans in the next few years. This was like in 2018, I think, is when he was talking about this. And the reason why is because within Serbia, as well as, well, specifically within Bosnia and Herzegovina, you have secessionist groups that, by the way, have support from Russia that want to be able to join Serbia, and that could break apart Bosnia. You still have Serbia unwilling to recognize Kosovo. And so you have also these territorial issues that I brought up in other regions. They're still evident in other parts of Europe, most notably in the Balkans. And so there's still the potential for renewed conflict there as well. So this is just a variety of the conflicts and crises and issues happening in the world that we've kind of set aside because we've talked so much, understandably so, but because we've talked so much about Ukraine, we've been overlooking all these other issues.
But does that mean they're not being attended to?
I think that these crises are being attended to behind the scenes. You have diplomats engaged with it, but it's not, but because it's not receiving the same attention, where problems can arise is when more resources have to be dedicated towards them. So if you're going to try to stop, say, a global food crisis that affects the African continent, which is a big area that they're concerned about this food crisis affecting, it's going to be harder to get the type of aid to acquire the kind of aid you need if no one's paying attention, right? And I'm not talking about food drives or drives such as to be able to generate public support. I'm talking about having, say, the U.S. authorize foreign aid, USAID type aid. Well, if the focus is on the war in Ukraine and hence the money and resources are going to the money in Ukraine, it's going to be harder to have, say, that assistance go towards other regions that are being affected. So that's one way in which, yes, there are still, of course, people in the diplomatic ranks who are focused on these issues, but there could become a problem with dedicating resources to these issues. A good example of this also is the war in Yemen, where the war in Yemen, if the U.S. is distracted by so many other things, then they're not going to dedicate the resources needed to potentially end that war because there's not going to be the same pressure to end that war. Think about how long the U.S. was actually supporting. So to walk it back a little bit for the listeners, several years ago, there was a lot of controversy during the Trump administration about the U.S. support to Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen. And specifically, the U.S. was providing armaments and even helping to carry out airstrikes in Yemen, not directly, but of course, providing like intelligence as well, but also providing a lot of the weapons and aircraft needed. And so there was suddenly efforts by Congress to end that, but it was because there was space for it to get attention. But with the war in Ukraine, there may not be space for it to get attention. And that leads to one other area that we have been overlooking, or at least a lot of folks have been overlooking recently. And that is proliferation, nuclear proliferation, specifically the Iran deal. That's something that is, Iran's on the verge of acquiring a nuclear bomb, and that's just not really getting much attention. And the reason why is because there's just, everything is focused on Ukraine. You also have North Korea still out there with other issues too. So my point is that there are a host of other things happening in the world besides Ukraine. But because Ukraine, the war in Ukraine is diverting so much attention and so many resources to it, it creates the possibility for these other issues to not just be ignored, but to not be resolved.